Blog Talk Radio.
The WHO have plans for Africa and Africans in does the WHO have plans for Africa and Africans in America? We'll be talking about that in a couple of minutes. Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace family, welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.usliftingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You will be on the Blog Talk Radio site at that time. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the follow button. Remember, we have our own social media community. Please join us if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as future, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. I'm Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Chewbacca, who, like me, is a member of Hulu. Peace, Brother Chewbacca. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, peace to you, Sister Q, and greetings to the family. I'm doing great. I'm doing fine. Excited, but sad, but excited about I came across some information which I wish to share with the family, and sad that I had to be the bearer of bad news.
Oh, we're going to take the bad news and turn it to good news. They got plans.
Yes, we will. We must.
So, Brother Chewbacca, what is WHO and what plans does it have for Africa and Africans in America?
Yeah, WHO, if people don't know, WHO is the acronym for World Health Organization. World Health Organization. And the closest thing that might come to mind, if you think of it in the context of the United States, would be a combination of NIH, which sends out money to do research on various diseases and pathogens, and of course the CDC, which becomes alert of any pathogenic infection that might spread, that had the tendency that might spread across the country. So WHO does it worldwide? It is an agency of the United Nations. Now keep this in mind. It's an agency of the United Nations. All right. The United Nations is a collection of countries, about 200. I think there's about maybe 194, 198 who have joined the WHO, the World Health Organization. But I'm going to make that association with some other things. But first, before I jump into that, I'd like to have you listen to Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. Now, you have listened to him before in a couple months ago when I presented. He's given a presentation in Davos, Switzerland in 2020 at the World Economic Forum. All right, that's the World Economic Forum, not the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum. Let's listen to what he has to say, and that will set the stage for what we're going to talk about this evening.
Century, the really big trouble will be against irrelevance. And it's much worse to be irrelevant than to be exploited. Those who fail in the struggle against irrelevance would constitute a new useless class. People who are useless, not from the viewpoint of their friends and family, of course, but useless from the viewpoint of the economic and political system. And this useless class will be separated by an ever-growing gap from the ever more powerful elite. The AI revolution might create unprecedented inequality, not just between classes, but also between countries. In the 19th century, a few countries like Britain and Japan industrialized first, and they went on to conquer and exploit most of the world. If we aren't careful, the same thing will happen in the 21st century with AI. We are already in the midst of an AI arms race, with China and the USA leading the race, and most countries being left far, far behind. Unless we take action to distribute the benefits and power of AI between all humans, AI will likely create immense wealth in a few high-tech hubs, while other countries will either go bankrupt or will become exploited data colonies. Now, we aren't talking about a science fiction scenario of robots rebelling against humans. We are talking about far more primitive AI, which is nevertheless enough to disrupt the global balance. Just think, what will happen to to developing economies, once it is cheaper to produce houses or cars in California than in Mexico.
Now, what a family, I'm going to continue that, but I need to make a reference here. You notice he used the term California and Mexico, because Mexico is usually the hub where you think of cheap labor. All right, cheap labor, in other words, the car industry, all right, will send work to the cheap labor in Mexico and then sell a finished product and sell it in California, which has probably the highest per capita, you know, in the country. But he says, suppose the reverse happening, and that's what he's talking about as a consequence of technology and AI. Let me continue so that he can explain a little bit more about what he means.
Okay. And what will happen to politics in your country in 20 years when somebody in San Francisco or in Beijing knows the entire medical and personal history of every politician, every judge, and every journalist in your country, including all their sexual escapades, all their mental weaknesses, and all their corrupt dealings? Will it still be an independent country, or will it become a data colony? When you have enough data, you don't need to send soldiers in order to control a country. Alongside inequality, the other major danger we face is the rise of digital dictatorships that will monitor everyone all the time. This danger can be stated in the form of a simple equation, which I think might be the defining equation of life in the 21st century. B times C times D equals R, which means biological knowledge multiplied by computing power multiplied by data equals the ability to hack humans, R.
Now listen to that, biological knowledge, computer power times computing power times data equals the ability to hack humans. All right. He goes on to explain a little bit what that is, but I'm trying to set the mode because remember now, our conversation is dealing with how does WHO, the World Health Organization, what it plans to do and how that affects Africa, the motherland, and Africans all over, including those of us here.
Okay.
If you know enough biology and you have enough computing power and data, you can hack my body and my brain and my life, and you can understand me better than I understand myself. You can know my personality type, my political views, my sexual preferences, my mental weaknesses, my deepest fears and hopes. You know more about me than I know about myself. And you can do that not just to me, but to everyone. A system that understands us better than we understand ourselves, can predict our feelings and decisions, can manipulate our feelings and decisions, and can ultimately make decisions for us.
Now, let me stop here because you said a whole mouthful there. And then you might ask yourself, well, what do you mean by hack? Because usually we think of hacking a computer, and usually that's a computer which is tied to a network, you know, like the Internet or some other network, and then gaining access. All right. Well, he's talking about that human beings will become so inanimated with artificial intelligence. And we've done that now, and all you got to do is look at your cell phone or your smartphone and think, you know, particularly some of us who have a little gray, that, you know, we didn't have such instruments, you know, decades ago. But now you ask the current generation of people, they would tell you, you know, that you cannot live without this, all right? And they have it by them, they're in their car, they're reading their emails, they're doing a whole bunch of stuff while they're driving. All right, so you can see we have become accustomed and indoctrinated to use this tool and then feel naked if we don't have that. Now, I'm going to play another clip of Brother Harari because he set the mode. He's at the World Economic Forum, All right. And this is composed of some of the top 1,000 plus businesses, the top 1,000 plus businesses and scholars and politicians. All right. The World Economic Forum. Think of the title, World, which includes the whole globe, Economic, all right, Forum, where such leadership begin to discuss. You say, well, what are they discussing? Well, we'll see about that. All right, let me play another clip from our honored guest and see more. Now, some of the family members might be saying, well, you know, who he made reference to people who will become trivial, all right? In fact, he used the term useless. And you might say, well, who is he talking about, in case you didn't know? Well, here he tells you exactly who he's talking about. Listen up.
All right.
What we're talking about now is like a second industrial revolution, but the product this time will not be textiles or machines or vehicles or even weapons. The product this time will be humans themselves. We are basically learning to produce bodies and minds. Bodies and minds are going to be, the two main products of the next wave. Once you know how to produce bodies and brains and minds, so cheap labor in Africa or South Asia or wherever, it could become.
Didn't you hear what he said? Cheap labor where, Sister Q? Africa and South Asia. That's India, all right, which has the largest one of the largest populations on the globe collection. Africa, the continent that has about as many people as China has, all right, a billion plus. All right, cheap labor. Now, for those of us who might be here in the United States, say, oh, he's not talking about me. Well, look at the unemployment status, and you know exactly who he's talking about. But let me let him continue as he goes on.
For nothing. And again, I think that the biggest question in maybe in economics and politics of the coming decade will be what to do with all these useless people.
All right, now we got all these useless people. You know, we got a billion useless people. We got 45 million useless people here. We got about 100 million useless people in Brazil. You know, we got useless people all over because we don't need them anymore. And he does, although he made references to Africa and Asia, as he goes on, and I didn't want to take up the time, but as he goes, because it's in another segment, as he goes on in the conversation, he says exactly who these useless people are, reference the U.S. by saying this, that we don't know what to do with these useless people. Maybe might give them some dope. That's what he says. All right. Or some video games. Now, see, he begins to do what? He begins to focus it on where we see an escapade of dope, and where we also see escapades of people just using digital games. And you find that a lot among Africans over here in the U.S. So he's not just talking about Africa. So family member, he's talking about you, all right, as being useless. Now, if we're useless, all right, what does that entail in terms of what's being planned, all right? Let me stop here just in case I know I'm a run off in case you might have a question or two, or maybe some question might be coming up from the family.
Let me check to see if there's anybody. No, we don't have any hands raised yet. I mean, Brother Shedbaki, you just be like blowing us out of the water, because this is information we don't get every day, you know. I watch the general news. I don't think that your local news is putting this out there. So when
the local news
go ahead.
Right, the local news is not putting it out there because the local news, all right, is corporate owned, and they only show the news by which they want to feed the people. Now, interestingly, the World Economic Forum is composed of all of these entities that control news. All right, I don't have time to list some of its membership, but you can go to their website. You know, just the World Economic Forum, com, I believe, or you can just put World Economic Forum or WEF, put it in your search mm-hmm. engine online, and they'll tell you about what they're for. You know, they don't make it a secret. You know, they tell you everything about themselves. But let me, you know, since I love this guy, Yuval Harari, let me also give you another comment that he makes. Dealing again, now remember, now we're useless. All right, we're useless. Okay. To whom will we be useless to? Now he's going to talk about who possibly, and he put this, I mean, you know, I'm taking a lot of his stuff out of comment because he gave presentations, and I'm just taking a little excerpt, all right? But he talks about if things are not done to be able to distribute equitably, all right, AI, all right, and he says in other presentations, you can't do that because it's so few people who can grasp the understanding because of the complexity in understanding computer science. And he goes, he gives an example in one forum that I heard where he talks about, well, right, you got a 50-year-old truck driver, all right, business go out, so, all right, now he's working at McDonald's, all right, or one of the gas stations that you see on the road, all right, you know, serving things, all right, so he's there. So his salary has been decreased. His utilization has been decreased in terms of how much he is distributing, not distributing, dedicating to society from his wages. All right. Eventually, he's going to be out on the street because the power of AI is that he can be easily replaced unless he becomes a computer scientist. Well, evidently, 50, 55 years old. He's not at that age. He has to compete with people, you know, 19 and 20. All right, so evidently he has to compete with his kids. But let's go on and listen to Brother Yuval again as he talks. I told you that he's an Israeli scholar. He's a philosopher and historian in Egypt. He teaches in Jerusalem University, but he makes the tour. He has several books. One of them is Sapien, and he talks about Sapien. In fact, he talks about it in this clip.
Okay.
He examines what might happen to the world when old myths are coupled with new godlike technologies, such as artificial intelligence and genetic engineering.
We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens. Within a century or two, Earth will be dominated by entities that are more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals or from chimpanzees. Because in the coming generation, we will learn how to engineer bodies and brains and minds. Now, how exactly will the future masters of the planet look like? This will be decided by the people who own the data. Those who control the data control the future, not just of humanity, but the future of life itself. Because today, data is the most important asset in the world. In ancient times, land was the most important asset. And if too much land became concentrated in too few hands, humanity split into aristocrats and commoners. Then in the modern age, in the last two centuries, machinery replaced land as the most important asset. And if too many of the machines became concentrated in too few hands, humanity split into classes, into capitalists and proletariat. Now data is replacing machinery as the most important asset. And if too much of the data becomes concentrated in too few hands, humanity will split not into classes. It will split into different species.
I think I played that before a couple months ago, in which he says that, you know, you got two classes of folks, those people who are useless, and he describes who the useless classes are. They are your black and brown folks around in the globe. All right. Now, keep that in mind now. There's a focus on Africa and India, but mostly Africa, and I'll show you in a minute why the focus is on Africa. All right. Number one, because it's the fastest growing population in the world. All right. Even much more so than you have in India and definitely China. All right. And then so you got a separation. People who are useless, what to do with these useless class. All right. And then you got those who are profiting, all right, from the new generation of technology, which is emergent. And these are the people who were the wealthy class in the prior revolution, you know, like he called the Industrial Revolution, which is now giving way to the AI and the technology revolution. So if you look at this, a class of people who are no longer needed, but they're the majority of people on the earth, and then you got a class of folks who owns everything, okay, all right, and who controls the data. And notice he talks about the data. Now, I haven't talked about, in addition to the cell phone, how is data collected? Well, he talks a little bit about that too. And so I'm going to get a little bit in that right now. Now, again, my emphasis is to connect this to who, all right, the World Health Organization, those people who are responsible for the health of the globe, the people of the globe. So we think. Well, let's see about that. All right. This is just last month, the World Health Organization Assembly, they call it the World Health Assembly, which is, you know, like all of the members come together, just like they have an assembly at the UN. So all of the members who are in the World Health Organization come together. Guess what? The assembly took place in Geneva, Switzerland, which is usually where the UN meet, where the UN headquarters is. All right. They met May 22nd through the 28th. Okay. Mm-hmm. The World Economic Forum down the street in Davos, Switzerland, all right, met May 22nd to the 26th. So they met around the same time. Okay. Now what I'm about to share with the family now is a conversation, because there was some things that was happening at the World Health Assembly, which was troubling to some of the people. They wanted to change some of the guidelines, and some of the guidelines seemed to give a little bit more strength to the World Health Organization, which is only an agency of the UN, and therefore would have and be able to demand of the various health agencies inside member states to comply with its wishes. All right. In other words, where the CDC, even the CDC and the NIH cannot tell the states what to do. They can make recommendations, although they tried it with COVID. All right. And, you know, a lot of lawsuits initiated, which said, no, you don't have that authority to tell local or rather state health agency what to do. And so a lot of lawsuits and administration failure. So the WHO is sort of like doing something. So a lot of people was concerned. And so this is one lawyer who was present at the WHO, and he's a litigator inside the U.S. Well, anyway, his name is John Titus, white boy. All right. And he'll tell you what his findings came up to be.
Hi, Greg, American attorney on positioning the World Health Organization in the larger landscape. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Polly. Can you hear me okay? Okay, great. Good afternoon, Europe. Good morning, United States. Again, as Polly said, my name is John Titus. I am a federal litigator here in the U.S. I've been doing that for 25 years. For the last 7 years, I have had a YouTube channel, now also a BitChute and an Odyssey channel called Best Evidence, that talks about a lot of the topics that we are talking about here today, including sovereignty, the rule of law, corruption, and transparency. My channel, however, focuses also on another issue, namely financial and monetary issues, which I want to touch on here briefly today for reasons that will become clear. All of the topics that we are talking about are becoming increasingly important as private companies move into and take over spaces, public spaces that are traditionally reserved to the democratic process, like health, and they do so the private companies move into these spaces under two different guises. It's really a 1-2 punch, as we've seen and we've heard about today. The first sort of gambit is there's a crisis, the most recent example being a pandemic. There's an emergency that justifies the suspension of the normal democratic process of transparent deliberation. The pitch is there's a panic, we need to act fast, we need to act now. And number two, the second part of the 1-2 punch is because we need to act quickly, because it's so important in the face of this crisis, we can't leave decisions to ordinary lay people and citizens in the democratic process. We need to turn the decision-making process over to experts and let these so-called experts decide. That, in a nutshell, is the premise of the WHO's new draft international health regulations. It's really suspend democracy and let global experts decide what's going to happen.
As I said earlier, there was some controversy based on these new regulation and guidelines. And right. Most of those regulation and guidelines were submitted by the United States government. Okay.
Oh, wow.
That drew the controversy. All right. But let me let him finish.
And I want to take a couple of minutes to explain where this comes from. It's a very important. It is not an accident. This feint really is not original to the U.S., to the WHO. It's actually a page from someone else's playbook. And you need to understand whose playbook this is, who those people are, and why they are so very dangerous. It is no accident that the new international health regulations are coming from and were proposed by the Biden administration, the U.S. executive branch, because it is the U.S. executive branch that is where the 1-2 expert punch, where that move started. And it started in the wake of the global financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. In the wake of that crisis, the economy was very fragile. And as crimes of Wall Street began to come to light, crimes that were really that really had drove the crisis, as people looked at why what created the crisis, a lot of crimes by Wall Street started to come to light, particularly in the mortgage-backed security space. But yet, despite the crimes coming to light, the executive branch was refusing to prosecute Wall Street no matter what the circumstances were. And people like myself are like, well, what's going on? You have the Department of Justice, which is in the executive branch. It never prosecuted Wall Street banks. It never prosecuted Wall Street bankers. It would only prosecute small-time chiselers, you know, the home flippers or, you know, the small-time hedge funders, you know, way, way far away from Wall Street. And finally, what happened toward the end of Obama's first term is that UBS, which will be near and dear to Swiss attorneys, UBS, which is also a major Wall Street bank, it's a primary dealer. It deals with both the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. It's a very important Wall Street player. UBS admitted to conducting or perpetrating wire fraud in connection with rigging LIBOR. And yet still, despite its confession, like Bernie Madoff, nobody went to jail. The DOJ, the Department of Justice, refused to prosecute. And I want to play a clip from the DOJ itself so you can hear their words. It's not my words. And you can see what they're saying about why UBS was not prosecuted in that case.
He's getting ready to play a clip, a video clip, which the family can't see. I can see it. And these are from the Department of Justice, the top officials of the Department of Justice, who are engaged in a press conference explaining why people didn't go to jail, all right, once they found out. And so their attempt is to try to explain why they didn't go to jail. Now listen to this.
Okay.
And I want to just highlight a couple of people here real quick. This guy is Lanny Brewer. He is the Assistant Attorney General in the DOJ. He is flanked by Eric Holder right here. Eric Holder is the Attorney General. That is cabinet position. He answers directly to President Obama. And they're talking about UBS Securities, as I mentioned, and they're – so Lanny Brewer has just explained why UBS is not going to be prosecuted, why nobody is going to go to jail. What they do not tell the people there in the press corps, these two guys, is they are both from a law firm called Covington & Burling, which actually represents all of Wall Street, including UBS. They don't mention that. And that's an important thing because I want you to listen. Eric Holder is going to step in here and rescue Lanny Brewer, who's just been annihilated by the press corps about why they're not prosecuting. Listen to what Holder says about why UBS gets off the hook.
In fact, if they're not, it's hard to,
let's be honest, yeah. I mean, that's a factor. I'm not talking about just this case. but in others that we have resolved. The impact on the stability of the financial markets around the world is something that we take into consideration. We reach out to experts outside of the Justice Department to talk about what are the consequences of actions that we might take.
Okay, you got that? So we reach out to experts, and they're going to, the experts tell us, oh, no, you can't follow the law. That would upset the stock market. The stock market, the market is still very fragile. The economy is fragile. In other words, it's just like here, we have an emergency. So the next question is, who are the experts? And I want to play you another clip from one of the same guys there, Lane Brewer. It's the only clip you will ever see where anybody in the Department of Justice actually reveals who the experts are. The guy who's going to speak here is Lane Brewer. You just saw him. He's Assistant Attorney General. Listen to what he says about why the DOJ or who the people are in the collateral consequences. He reveals who they are in this clip here. He is talking to the New York City Bar Association. Listen to what he says.
We are frequently on the receiving end of presentations from defense counsel, CEO.
Oh, sorry about that. Here we go.
We are frequently on the receiving end of presentations from defense counsel, CEOs, and economists who argue that the collateral consequences of an indictment would be devastating, just devastating for their client, and that even global markets will feel the effects.
So in other words, in the wake of the crisis, the economy is fragile, and the crimes that Wall Street commits, they're not being prosecuted because experts are coming into the DOJ, and when Lanny Brewer just reveals there, it's actually the CEOs and economists from the very law firms that are being prosecuted. And so that's the reality. It was defense counsel, CEOs, and economists. And so he was saying, well, the global market's going to feel the effects. So the DOJ, the end result, is never prosecuted Wall Street, despite the fact that they're confessing to crimes like Bernie Madoff did. To be clear, the decision to ignore U.S. law and not to indict Wall Street came from Wall Street itself. And it,
now, sister, I don't know if you understand the importance of family, if you understand the importance of that. But number one, I'm sorry, I know people love the Obama administration, Eric Holden, you know, but they are lawyers from a firm that represented, you know, most of the clients on Wall Street, particularly your big bankers, okay? And he represented his firm, the firm that he worked for represented UBS, which is I believe it's a Dutch bank, one of the largest. A Dutch or German, one of the two, but it's one of the largest, in Europe, if not, and also one of the biggest in the world. All right, so the experts are the representatives from the businesses themselves that are being prosecuted. Okay.
Exactly.
Now,
sure.
I'm trying to get the family to see the corruption, the connection. A little bit, but you might say, well, okay, I understand that. That's with, what does that have to do with the World Health Organization,
yes,
which is concerned about? Well, let him tell you.
Came disguised, just like here, as experts advising the U.S. executive branch on what to do in an emergency, the emergency there being a fragile economy, which is exactly what you have with the WHO experts rendering advice. The benefits private parties funding the WHO. The WHO website actually admits, if you look at it, that the second largest donor to the WHO is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm just going to cut to a graphic. From there, you can see Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is second in the list of donors to the WHO.
Now, you don't see the list, family, but I see the list that he has here. All right, Bill and Melinda Gates, all right, contribute in 2020 and 2021, $751 million. The United States only contributed, which was the third, all right, $693 million. But interestingly, German contribute over a trillion.
Wow.
I mean, a billion, I'm sorry. I mean, Germany contribute over a billion. They were the first to contribute to the WHO. But I want to know this. See, Bill and Melinda Gates represent the private sector. You know,
exactly.
They're not public. All right, they're the
right.
private sector, okay? And they had the largest contribution. Now, listen to this, then you begin to see how the interworkings of the WHO and business.
Okay.
$751 million, and that is only in 2020 and 2021. That's a lot of money that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is donated, and I want to highlight the fact that Bill Gates is on record talking about how he personally profited from vaccines. So I want to cut to this clip and just listen to what Bill Gates tells CNBC here.
You've invested $10 billion in vaccinations over the last two decades, and you figured out the return on investment for that. It kind of stunned me. Can you walk us through the math?
It's been $100 billion overall that the world's put in. Our foundation is a bit more than $10 billion.
So if,
but we feel there's been...
So his foundation contributed at least one-tenth of what the world put in.
Over a 20-year return.
I think the numbers that you ran through were if you had put that money into an S&P 500 and reinvested the dividends, you'd come up with something like $17 billion, but you think it's $200 billion here.
Did you see what he said? $200 billion. He says 20-to-1. I was talking over that so you didn't hear. He invested, and he felt his return to him was 20-to-1. All right.
Okay.
And here's a... All right, Titus, to continue. Now, this is he's being interviewed by CNBC.
Yeah. Okay, so Bill Gates has put $750 million into the WHO in the last 2 years, and he's put $10 billion total into vaccines. Query what role the WHO plays in Bill Gates achieving a 2,000% return on his investment. Well, for one thing, the WHO conceals all facts that do not promote the advantages of vaccines. It is basically an advertising agency for vaccines. Take a look at what the WHO says on its website about the Pfizer vaccine. It is quite interesting and revealing what the WHO's website, their own website, says about Pfizer's vaccine, and they will pay attention to what they're not saying as well. Here is their website, and you can see what they say. The Pfizer COVID-19 mRNA vaccine is safe and effective. Now let's look at what they are not telling you. And you can see Pfizer right down here in the bottom. Now I want to look at what they're not telling you. This is from the Bayer's website. It's a CDC. It talks about the dangers of the vaccine. And you find just by a search on the CDC's own website that there are 28,312 cases where the vaccine was COVID-19, of which Pfizer is obviously a big player, and the patient died. So if a vaccine that has killed 28,000 people is deemed safe and effective by the WHO. Now, the other thing that the WHO is not telling you about Pfizer is that Pfizer is a criminal enterprise that has been caught in criminal fraud before. This is from the DOJ's own website. Pfizer to pay a 2.3.
Now, family, I know that you can't see this. I can see this. In fact, I have the document about the lawsuit that was brought by the Department of Justice against Pfizer. Well, the indictment,
right.
Really. All right, and he goes and describes it.
$3 billion fine for fraudulent marketing, okay? This is they're pleading guilty to a felony violation for misbranding their drugs and
They plead guilty. Keep that in mind. I mean, they didn't try to fight it. Yeah, they plead guilty. They know they did it. Who went to jail?
Misleading people about their drugs. They're paying the largest criminal fine ever imposed by the United States for any matter, Pfizer is. The WHO doesn't seem, they don't deem it worthy to mention to you that Pfizer is guilty of fraud in misrepresenting the safety and the efficacy of their medicines. So the conclusion here is the U.S. executive branch has worked for private corporations and banks since the global financial crisis. Its MO is to replace the democratic process and the rule of law by replacing it with the rule by private corporations and banks in particular on our own top. It does so the executive branch by using emergency and crises to justify all manner of undemocratic regulations. It cites the authority of so-called experts who stand to gain financially and professionally. Bill Gates gaining financially, Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, their law firm gaining professionally, by advancing their company's interests in the name of the public good and to the detriment of the public. And that's a real problem. Wall Street, I'm going to tell you right now, got away with these crimes because Wall Street possesses one thing that the big pharmaceutical companies do not. And this
This is important. You got to listen to this. Family, you got to listen to what he's saying here, how Wall Street has an advantage over the pharmaceutical and why they have such an advantage. Mm. Although I'm not talking about Wall Street right now. I'm talking about really the pharmaceutical and WHO.
This is what you need to pay attention to. The pharmaceutical companies don't really have any sovereign powers. Wall Street banks did. They have the power of money creation. They can threaten the government with, you know, we'll shut down your money supply. You're going to have tanks in the street. You're going to have Armageddon. Those threats actually were leveled in the lead up to the bailout of 2008. Big Pharma does not have that kind of leverage. So you have a chance to get out of the WHO. You can opt out, urge your government officials to opt out, sign petitions, fight the WHO tooth and nail. And that's what we all need to do. I thank you for your time and attention.
Yeah. Family, what I'm trying to show here is that the WHO is not as clean as we might expect it to be. One, based on the amount of money that it receives more money from private donors than it does from governments. And the government, you remember now, it's an agency of the United Nations. All right.
Yeah.
All right. And the members of the United Nations is what fund the United Nations. Well, we find out that what's funding an agency of the United Nations are, you know, the private sector, all right, and particularly the private drug companies or pharmaceuticals. I think the importance of that, sister, and let me stop here just in case you might have another question or a question. I know I've been running through this. I had a number of things I wanted to share because they're out there, and I know that probably the average family member just don't know what's out there. But we need information. How do information help us? It prepares us and tells us how to navigate, you know, some of the stumbling blocks, all right? Because a lot of times, if you don't navigate, you know, you'll be wondering why you're not making any progress. Well, because you don't know. So when you do know, you can navigate and you can avoid those stumbling blocks that are there as you move towards your goal. So let me stop here, sister, just to see if there's anybody that might have a question or want to convert.
There's no one with that.
There is one.
There is no one. What I wanted to say though is, you know, they use that term safe and effective, and clearly that term has a different meaning to them than it has them being the pharmaceutical, the World Health Organization, the government. Those people, Harari, trying to kill people, it's safe and effective for getting rid of people. We think they mean it's safe and effective against whatever disease they're talking about at the moment. But they always tell you, no, it's not going to keep you from getting the disease. It's not going to keep you from spreading the disease. However, it's safe and effective, meaning it's safe for us to give it to you, and we know it will be effective in getting rid of you because
you haven't heard it. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt your thought.
No, I was just saying it's effective in getting rid of you because we have determined that you are useless. We don't have any plans for you.
There you go. That's the connection that I was trying to make. Remember now, we're a useless being, all right? So how do we deal with those people who are useless? I mean, they're just there. We got almost 8 billion people, all right, and the majority of those 8 billion people are people who are not Europeans, all right, therefore have color, melanin in their skin. And the fastest growing population is the original people, okay, the original people from the continent of Africa. We were the fastest growing here in the U.S., but, you know, they did some stuff to us. Now, let me switch over to the World Economic Forum a little bit more. I led with the World Economic Forum last year. Now I'm at the World Economic, 2 years ago in 2020. Now I'm right here. And who do we have right here? I'm going to let you listen to the conversation, and I'll tell you the significance of that if you might not be able to understand it, between Klaus Schwab, is about an 80-year-old, maybe a little bit, maybe a year or two older, okay? He's German. He is the CEO of the World Economic Forum. And little is known that he is also a protege of Henry Kissinger.
Okay.
Former Secretary. All right. All right. Yeah, you know, Henry had some way out ideas. All right. He's talking to a guy, Dr. Boula, B-O-U-R-L-A, who is the current CEO of Pfizer. All right, listen to their conversation.
My announcements is forming. Can you tell me the person a bit more? First of all, thank you for the honor, gentlemen, to be here with you. Today we announced that we will offer all our patent-protected medicines, all vaccines or medicines that currently exist in the U.S. or in Europe, to the 45 poorest countries of the world, which is a population of 1.2 billion people, at cost. And we also make the commitment that every year, as we discover and bring to the U.S. or to the, Europe or to the world, new medicines, automatically those new medicines will be inserted into the offer of the portfolio that we will offer into these countries. I think that it's really fulfilling of a dream that we had together with my leadership team when we started in 19. The first week we met in January of 19 in California and to set up the goals for the next 5 years. And one of them was by 2023, we will reduce the number of people in the world that cannot afford our medicines by 50%. I think today this dream is becoming a reality.
All right, so what he is saying is that he's going to reduce, he's going to give out his patented medicine to the world at no cost, to the 45 poorest countries in the world. All right, now I'm going to let him continue to tell you who some of those poorest countries in the world that he's going to give his medicine at cost are, and what he's going to also, how he's going to help build their infrastructure.
Okay.
So it's really a purpose-driven company, and if you say at cost without margin, or certainly you must add a certain margin for research and development, we will not. We define at cost strictly what it takes to manufacture it, and very minimal shipment. We exclude all the research money that took to invent the medicines, all the legal to make the contracts, or everything, or the administrative cost, everything that it is sometimes is added to the nonprofit will not be added in that case. It's going to be strictly the cost to make and ship. If I think of all the discussions during the last year related to
What you hear is this is Klaus Schwab, the CEO, talking to Boila.
Mm-hmm.
COVID medicine, I think this is such a breakthrough. And if you see how many people...
He said the COVID medicine was a breakthrough, right? And, you know, I think Attorney Titus told you 28, near 29,000 people have been killed from the injection.
People in the developing world, and here I can immediately come in with a question. When we talk about the developing world, whom do you help? I mean, are all countries included? Or,
yeah.
We use the principle, so we are including all the low-income countries, according to the World Bank definition, there are 27. But because there is always gray line between the income of countries that they are not anymore because they improved a little bit, but still they cannot afford. We decided that every country that used to be low income, but they graduate to higher level, the last 10 years will also be included. That gives us 45 countries, which are 1.2 billion of population. 1.2 billion.
Yes.
And would you help those countries also afterwards to develop their own production line? What we are going to do, and this is a very good point, but what we
He's saying they're going to help you to build their own infrastructure.
Cover through
so they can kill
the pandemic
them.
Was the supply.
Exactly.
Was not enough to resolve the issues that these countries are having. Right now, for example, there are billions of doses of our vaccine, the vaccine that was used in Europe, in the U.S., but it is offered to low-income countries for free. And it is offered by the U.S. government mainly, but also by the European Union, but they're doing donations. So the U.S. government bought for us at cost, and they donated. they can't use them right now. Because we discovered that one thing is supply and the other thing is to have educated population that believe the vaccines is doing well.
You said an educated population, that just means an indoctrinated population who think the vaccine works.
Mm-hmm.
To have doctors or nurses that will administer, to have infrastructure and logistical that you can store it in every place in the country and not only in the capital of the country. A lot of things are missing. For this reason, given the lessons that we got, in addition to the initiative that is brought and addresses 45 countries, we selected five of them that the governments are really keen to work on these issues as well. Those five.
Check out the five.
Rwanda, Malawi.
Rwanda.
Uganda.
Malawi.
Ghana, and Senegal. So with those five, we signed.
Five countries in Africa.
Our letters of intent, and we will work not only giving them the medicines, but on the ground to identify blockages between the medicine arrives in the country and the medicine is used by a patient. Is it?
Now, I got to stop here to say that. Right now, you know, they're going to work with them to bring, give them the medicine to remove the blockages. You got to understand this. You know, only 10% of the African continent, you know, have been where they have vaccinated. Interestingly, less than two-thirds of the population, the black population here, in the U.S. has been vaccinated, all right? Most of the vaccination is with the European population here, and most of the vaccination worldwide is with the European population in Europe and Israel, all right? So what he's talking about is removing these blockages. Why aren't these folks getting this jab in the arm? Now, I want to jump right quickly because he talks about those five African countries. Companies. Now, here's countries. All right. Here's the president of Malawi and unfortunately, Rwanda, too. You know, I like Paul Kigali, but, you know, hey, money talks. All right. Here's the president of Malawi who definitely sounded like he was educated here. He's a PhD. All right. But he's the president of Malawi, which is, you know, right next to the Mozambique.
Thank you very much. This one. President Chakwera, can you share with us how this accord is going to impact the people of Malawi?
On behalf of the people of Malawi, I'm honored to join my brother, President Paul Kagame, Mr. Bill Gates, and thanks to Dr. Bula and Angela Wang.
Now, remember, Bill Gates is sitting right next to him, and they're at the World Economic Forum. And Brother Titus earlier just told you how much money the Bill and Melinda Gates gave WHO.
Right. And they told you they wanted to kill
charge towards the creation of a healthier world through this historic and unprecedented accord with Pfizer. This accord is the embodiment of what the World Economic Forum is all about, namely a strategic synergy between decision makers from government, private sector, and civil society to enable these three stakeholders to do together on a global scale what they cannot do alone. The beauty of this accord for countries like Malawi and Rwanda is that it is not a handout, but a real partnership that involves taking Pfizer's strength in manufacturing, Mr. Bill Gates' strength in philanthropy, and our strength in governance and combining them in a spirit of shared sacrifice to put human progress ahead of business profits and political posturing. And for Malawi, where access to quality medicines and vaccines is a real challenge, this accord means that our quest for universal health care in Malawi has a real shot. And I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you for those inspiring words. Mr. Gates, how do you hope this call to action will advance progress and innovation in global health?
Well, the primary focus
of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is to improve health equity. That's what Melinda and I picked back in the year 2000, where we first got going. And partnerships with companies like Pfizer have been key to the progress we've made. And for example, Gavi got started, actually announced here at Davos. One of the most important vaccines, the one that saved the most lives of all, is the pneumococcus vaccine. And Pfizer was the innovator there with their Prevnar product. And they've been providing that at low cost so that it can get out to all the children of the world.
Agreement.
Today's announcement is a strong additional commitment by Pfizer to take their incredible capabilities and make sure that they get out to everyone in the world. For all the drugs they do create, the commitment to have the COGS-based pricing, that will improve accessibility. Pfizer is also committing to a partnership with the foundation to create new products. Two of those will be Group B streptococcus vaccine, which in future events we can brief you on how that will save hundreds of thousands of lives, and likewise an RSV vaccine. These are vaccines you give to the mother, maternal vaccines, and so doing the trials exactly right requires the deep expertise that Pfizer has, so we're super pleased to work together with them.
Okay, he goes on to talk about the important thing I wanted to bring out here is that they have a relationship with Pfizer. Okay,
right.
Bill and Melinda Gates, all right, has a relationship with Pfizer. All right, Pfizer is a corrupt, you know, entity. All right, Bill and Melinda Gates definitely has a relationship with the World Health Organization. And I'm going to play this last clip. I hope this thing comes out right.
Great crises, climate change, soon it'll be overpopulation.
A formidable convergence of disease, drought, famine, and war fueled by climate change, inequity, and geopolitical rivalry.
War. So they're going to step in?
That was one of the guys who was narrating this. I wanted to really go to this is what I'm about to play for you now is the CEO who also attended the World Economic Forum. This is the CEO of Moderna, which is the other.
That's the mRNA, right?
The next stream. Let's check out this clip. This is crazy.
As Steph knows, we're now throwing those into the garbage. It's sad to say. I'm in the process of throwing 30 million doses into the garbage because nobody wants them.
He's talking about his vaccine.
Okay.
It's a demand problem. We right now have governments. We try to contact not only Steph, who is doing great work with his team trying to get demand into the countries, but also we contacted through the Washington, the embassies in Washington, every country, and nobody wants to take them. And so the challenge we have now is a very different situation than we had 2 years ago. The problem we had 2 years ago is there was no mRNA capacity in the world, zero. The situation is very different today. Moderna has 3 billion doses of annual capacity. Pfizer has 4 billion doses, that's 7 billion doses. And the Chinese don't want the vaccines of mRNA. So if you just take the Chinese population out, you have more than a dose per person. And as we just discussed, the issue in many countries is people don't want vaccine. In the U.S., people don't want vaccine. Around the world, we have a lot of people who don't want the vaccine, as from Steph and his team are working again. So we don't have a capacity issue around the planet. It's not true. It was true 2 years ago. It's not true today.
All right. Family, I know that we're running over, but I just wanted to bring out the point is that they have enough vaccine for the world, but the countries don't want them. All right. I already told you that in Africa, all right, only about 10% of the population and that might be high, have been vaccinated. And Africa, America, all right, only less than 33% of the population has been vaccinated, all right? People don't trust it. Well, they don't trust it because they've seen, a lot of them have seen some of the negative effects and impact of it, all right? And they've been brutalized and pushed to do that, so they're a little skeptical. We're not stupid. We are intimidated a lot because we were brought here. We can't go no place else. So I'm making the point that what is in store for us by WHO leadership is not help. It is the continued exploitation, all right, and utilization and marginalization, you know, by large pharmaceuticals companies. Now, they talked about the Wall Street, of which the pharmaceuticals are a part, and that's another day. But the important thing I wanted to reflect on here is how does ULU address this current problem if these white folks who've been talking at these international conferences are correct? ULU has to have this game plan, all right, to begin to address where we are locally. We have to educate. We have to inform, all right? They talked about food bank, food deserts. We haven't even talked about that yet. That's another topic. All right. They have to be able to get into the life of the community and show that they are a viable solution, all right, against the hell that they have been experiencing, at least for the past 2.5 years. This is the message that we have to give out. This is the message that we have to show, all right, because these people, these Europeans, they are not stopping. They have the resources. They bribe our people. You show what they did with the brother from Malawi, all right, who was one of the chosen few, okay? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about the infrastructure. Haven't talked at all about the traditional medicine that have helped the people who have caught COVID. He hasn't mentioned that, you know, throughout Africa, all right? I know in Senegal personally, you know, medicine that, you know, they couldn't get, because they couldn't get the vaccine over there, they was glad they couldn't get it. They used the traditional medicine, traditional healers. So I'm bringing all this to say that we have some things to do. It's my pleasure, and I'm thankful that, Sister Q, that you gave me the opportunity to share the information that I've been able to collect. Hopefully this has impacted others to begin to look into the stuff. Don't take things at face value, all right? Fortify themselves up because we do have a journey ahead of us. And thank you very much.
thank you, Brother Shabaka, for all that very good information. And I hope people will follow up and do some of their own research, because that's what we need, people to find the information and share it. We want to thank everyone who joined us this evening. We will be back next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace. I'm